Good evening, this is Sister Faye Talk. You're listening to 93.5 Unity FM. Behind the headlines, myself, Syed Ahmed, and Tariq Diaz. Well, it's a rather special show today, actually. We have got live guests. Voices you'll be familiar with over the phones, but today they're here in flesh. I have with me Tony Govling. Hi, Tony.
Hi, Zaid.
And we have Martin Summers.
Hello.
And another voice you'll be familiar with is Mr. Stephen Jolly.
Hello.
And of course, myself and Tariq and Humayun, the usual trio, also here as well. 01217728892. Plenty of topics coming up today. We're going to be talking about CCTVs. We're going to be going to the Middle East a little bit with the events that are taking place there. We're also going to be talking about census, which is coming up very, very soon, I believe. And many, many other topics besides. If you have any comments, anything you want that interests you, and you want to participate, 0121-772-8892, drop us a text, 0792684338, or you can go to our Facebook page, Behind the Headlines, and you'll see lots of lovely pictures of newspapers. That would be the right page. So you can drop us a comment there as well. We'll read it out on the airwave. Yeah, and if you want to drop us a line, if you can't do it now, and you've got access to email, Behind the Headlines, line35@hotmail.co.uk. Good evening, Derek.
Good evening.
Well, we've got a fantastic show lined up, and an action-packed one as well. Tell us a little bit more of what we've got coming up.
Well, yes, we've got today, as you mentioned, Tony and Martin from
If you would come closer to the mic, Derek.
Tony and Martin from Bristol City FM are joining us live in the studio today, and we also have Steve Jolly as well, who's a regular guest on Unity FM shows and will need no introduction to the listeners. You can call us on 0121-772-8892, but let's get straight into the talk, and we'll kick off with Steve today, because we have a little piece which is related to Birmingham itself, and something we've been covering over about a year and a half or so now is the issue of CCT cameras in Birmingham and how far things have progressed. So, Steve, a bit of an update?
Yeah, people have been asking me quite a lot lately about Project Champion, saying, well, what's happening with these cameras? I thought they were coming down. And they are, but slowly. I had a meeting with the police last Thursday, and they said that they're going to start phase one of taking the whole system down in April. So throughout the month of April, we should see these cameras being removed from the posts. And phase two is going to be removing the posters themselves, and that's going to be done more towards the autumn. So we should see the whole lot being removed and taken away. But where they're being removed to is another matter. The police authority weren't able to or willing to confirm what was happening to them. They suggested they might want to redistribute them somewhere else in the West Midlands. But I have heard from a BBC source that apparently from a police source in London that they are going down to the Met. So I have a feeling they might be being put up around the Olympic area prior to the 2012 Olympics. So we'll hopefully find out exactly what's happening to them. But they are being taken down.
Now, you've been on the news recently, actually, on local in Scotland, was it? Border News?
Yeah, ITV Border Television, that's right up in the northwest of England, Carlisle.
Right up close to Scotland, yes.
Yeah, just before Scotland. I was just commenting for a national campaign group, No CCTV,
yes,
who I did a lot of work with, on the council cuts up there. Local people are up in arms because they're cutting the funding for their CCTV systems. When all that means really is that they're just reducing the hours of monitoring, so they're not going to be monitored 24/7. And of course you get the inevitable cries from people, whether it be local councillors or residents, saying, doesn't that mean there'll be a massive crime wave? Well, of course it doesn't mean that at all. People have a massive faith in the capabilities of what CCTV can do and what it's for. And basically, it's quite useless, really.
I've always been one of them, Steve. I've always thought, you know, that I've been told that these CCTVs can catch, you know, offenders, you know, people causing trouble in the streets at night, things like that. So this is not the case.
Well, no, people believe that, and that is certainly the message that's put forward by the media. The media seems to be very pro-CCTV. There's always a story in it. There's good copy and good images, and you know, every single day there's a few CCTV stories in the press, and it does create this impression that, you know, how would we catch any bad guys if we didn't have these cameras? But it contradicts massively with the known facts, the research studies and evaluations that have been done, which say quite the opposite. Which, you know, their conclusions are that CCTV has had no significant impact on crime. Most of the studies ever done, you know, from the early 90s through to the most recent one, which was 2008, a report by the Campbell Collaboration, which actually was a sort of meta-analysis of 41 different studies, evaluations. And it started off with about 100, so it was meant to be the definitive study into CCTV in Britain. And it discounted those which weren't done to any academic peer-reviewed standard, that didn't have control elements, and they whittled it down to 41. And their conclusions were that CCTV had had no significant impact on crime. But this is not what people believe, is it?
Can I just chip in there, guys? Because I mean, really, I can't see how it can't have an impact on crime, because you've got your old-fashioned police with no CCTV. Surely, with this amazing extra bit of technology, with extra eyes all over the place, and also the CCTV images being recorded, surely it can't fail to make a dent in crime.
Well, that's what we believe, but that's not what the evidence tells us. Every study ever done contradicts what we believe. What we believe is projected through the media and by the police, and we, as British public, have totally bought into this idea that this is how we police now, by camera. But every single study done into it suggests that it's, you know, while there have been some cases where, you know, something has been witnessed and, you know, there's been a crime linked, you know, to this evidence, we believe that this is how crimes are solved, and it simply isn't the case.
Yeah, but, you know, you think, by logic, if you've got a whole load of cameras recording potential crime all over a city, it's bound to help the police. I mean, you know, I must admit, I do have my doubts myself, especially since, I mean, I've done a lot of research over the years into the 7/7 London bombings, and you would expect that there would be CCTV pictures released of the bombers, maybe even from the trains and from the bus, as they were blowing up their bombs. Funnily enough, though, nothing at all from the actual sites of where those bombs went off. So this does, you know, I can see what you're saying, really, in that there's all these cameras everywhere. And I can remember when John Charles de Menezes was shot in the London Underground, that John Snow from Channel 4 News took his mother down the escalators, down into Stockwell Tube Station, down through the tunnels and onto the platform, and they counted nearly 40 CCTV cameras. And yet we were told afterwards that actually there was no CCTV of John Charles de Menezes going down and being pursued by the police.
Come in here actually as well, Steve. We see all these CCTV cameras, and they're wonderful, you know, crime, fighting the crime and things like that. But a lot of the time, that's what I'm going to come on to. And a lot of the time, we sometimes find that the CCTV cameras either have got, they forgot to put a tape in there, or accidentally the tape actually got wiped off.
Well, are there not occasions where they're actually fake, if I'm correct as well? Some of them are not even, you know, they're not switched on, or they're just not real.
Empty shelves, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Well, arguing for more effective CCTV is effectively arguing for greater intrusion and invasion of privacy. So as cameras are upgraded to become high definition, colour, zoom, pan, tilt, where you can, you know, really follow somebody around a large area from one camera to another, surely that's, you know, in making them more effective, what you're really doing is eroding our civil liberties and freedoms further, because you're effectively saying that everyone must be watched all the time, and that you have no right not to be under surveillance as soon as you leave your front door.
Is there any evidence that suggests that, you know, these CCTV cameras are being used for things other than solving crimes?
Well, we've seen an example here in Birmingham where it was pitched. Well, it wasn't even pitched. We were only given an explanation as to what they were for when we demanded an answer. We demanded to know what they were. I mean, they were just put up. And we were told it was for community safety and antisocial behaviour and vehicle crime and things like that. But, of course, It wasn't. It was a counter-terrorism spying operation to monitor the Muslim population of Birmingham. So, yeah, we do have examples.
I mean, something also I heard that when this camera actually went up in these Muslim areas, that what actually really got people's attention is because one of the cameras actually pointed at a mosque directly. Is there any truth in that?
I'm thinking of a photographic image that was used that was sort of quite sort of iconic in the media. Image of a camera looking as it was pointing at the top of the mosque. But most of them were, in fact, automatic number plate recognition cameras. So they automatically record the comings and goings of vehicles that are driving by. So it's basically vehicle tracking and databasing that information and keeping it for years. So everyone's movements are recorded by the state.
Can I just say that these ANPR cameras, they're actually quite easy to recognise, aren't they, Steve? They are blue, dark blue in colour, or green in colour. They're mounted often on urban motorways and dual carriageways and large A roads, on bridges and also by the side of the road. So that's the ANPR automatic number plate recognition system. I remember when they first came in, they had these signs on them saying, "This is not a speed camera." The idea being, of course, to dissuade people from taking, a coping saw or a metal saw to them and taking them down, like which was the fashion with the speed cameras at the time. So they are basically a system called ANPR, which you can look up on the internet if you've got the internet and find out all about that. But that was based on something which I'm going to ask Martin to talk about now, which is started in Northern Ireland called Glutton, which was a system for taking in all of the number plates of every single vehicle that was driving around in Northern Ireland during the Troubles.
Yeah, well, I mean, what's been happening recently in Birmingham has been normal in Belfast and Derry for donkey's years. And of course, if you're a terrorist, what you do is you wait until about half an hour before you're driving your bomb to the target. You steal a car before it can be reported as stolen. And then, of course, you trick the system because they don't know, you know. And of course, this is the thing. I mean, real terrorists who really know what they're doing are not deterred by CCTV cameras.
No, and that's pretty much everyone commented that on that when it was first uncovered that this was a sort of semi-covert spying operation. But if you really are a terrorist, it's not going to...
No, if you're a professional terrorist, you can find your way around that, and you can also send people the wrong way to be and fool the system. I think it's more to do with intimidating the Muslim community,
yeah,
and preventing them from speaking out against things that they don't approve of. But I think what's happened here in Birmingham, where activists like yourself and the Muslim community have got together and got to the bottom of it and made the police back down... Well, it shows that, you know, if you do things right, then you can get results, doesn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. Just want to move on from this topic now. And, well, I received my census letter in the paper today. This is the 2011 census. And I know that, you know, there's a lot of controversy about it. And Steve Jolly will definitely tell us a bit more. I mean, it's Lockheed Martin who are conducting the census. And if anyone wants to know who Lockheed Martin are, they're a U.S. arms manufacturer. Fascinating how a U.S. arms manufacturer is conducting the UK census, and should we be worried about the amount of data that they're asking us to give?
Well, even at the level of gut feeling, something feels wrong, doesn't it, when you've got an arms manufacturer also, you know, venturing out into other areas of business, like conducting a census for another sovereign state. Now, Lockheed Martin, they don't just, you know, people think that, oh, there's an ethical objection there because I'm against war and I don't like bombs and they make bombs, so I don't agree with them doing the census. But it goes much deeper than that. It's, you know, this Lockheed Martin is involved in a lot of things. It's a massive company. I think, about 80% of the US military's equipment and services are provided by Lockheed Martin. I mean, they are absolutely huge. But they don't just manufacture weapons and bombs and planes and stuff like that. They provide surveillance and data processing.
So this goes back to what we've been talking about again, the same thing about surveillance again, the constant spying system, this kind of Orwellian world, you know, that seems to be kind of like slowly manifesting itself
into
reality.
Yeah, but surely, guys, if you've done nothing wrong, you've got nothing to worry about with this system.
So they keep telling us.
Unless you're the police on the day that John Charles Menezes was shot, when the system is conveniently switched off or wiped or whatever.
Or what constitutes wrong?
Well, that's it. Who's making the laws as to what's wrong? I mean, it's quite conceivable that it might soon be an offence for a, you know, peaceful assembly of more than half a dozen people. You know, we're getting into the situation where we're having more what you might call civil unrest, protest, peaceful protest, and some of them violent protests.
Mm. And another aspect, of course, of all this is public money that's paying for these cameras, but often it's private security companies which are owning, managing, well, not necessarily owning, but certainly managing and running these surveillance systems. Just as a sort of sideline here, on the London Underground is actually run by a private company called Verint Systems. I mean, this company, Verint Systems, actually got into a big scandal in the United States and had to change their name to Verint from a company called Converse Infosys. And this is actually an Israeli-owned company, and it's running the private security, these security cameras, on the London Underground. So one wonders, what, you know, if most people who are on the London Underground, and there's something like 7 million, 6, 7 million people a day use London public transport, do they know that it's actually an Israeli company whose parent company, the boss, is on the run from the American Securities and Exchange Commission, and he's on the run in Africa? He's run away with $13 million. I actually spoke to some police in London about this, some armed police, about a year and a half ago, and they were actually quite shocked, and they wanted to take the details, what's the name of this company, and took my card away. But it's actually a fact that the London Underground's security cameras, and maybe Steve can enlighten us about some of the cameras here in Birmingham, is actually run by a private Israeli company, which I can actually officially call on the radio a crooked firm, because the boss is on the run, having absconded with $13 million, and the American government, the Securities and Exchange Commission, in fact, who run their stock exchange, police their stock exchange, is after the guy. So why are people like this running private security networks? That's what I'd like to know.
That's a good question. I can't, you know, that is, very few people know that. I mean, you know, we imagine that cameras are either run by the police or perhaps the local authority, or they're, you know, obviously if it's in a shop, then it's the shopkeeper that owns the camera. But, you know, people don't question who's doing the surveillance and who's watching the watchers.
I think it's the same.
It's all about accountability at the end of the day, isn't it? Where's the line of accountability? Because this is an enormous power to give people. Mm. And if they're going to have that power, they themselves must be accountable.
Yes.
And there's also this double standards where we're often told there are lots of situations where we as members of the public are not allowed to take out a camera and film anything. You know, private property is the first one. So if you go into the Bullring, massive shopping centre, people everywhere, you know, terraces, coffee shops, and it's all open. As soon as you do something that they don't want you doing, the private security firm will come and eject you, or tell you this is private property, you're not allowed to do this, that, or the other. And filming in public is one of those things. It's not an offence to film in public, and I think the police should particularly be prepared to be filmed when they're performing their duties.
Well,
my
experience,
they don't like it,
well,
though, do they?
In my experience, actually, often the police don't mind filming. I mean, when there's a confrontation of some sort going on, the police, if they're on the scene, are very often the focus of attention. Both sides are arguing with the police, I want to do this. And if you turn up with a camera and start filming, my experience is the police look at you with a big smile on their face. Thankfully, someone's filming this. And actually, because that often diverts the energy of the dispute away from the police and onto you who's filming. People start looking at you. What are you doing filming this? And my experience actually with the police has been very good on this. The police do know the law. It is perfect. You're perfectly within your rights to film in a public place. But as you say, Steve, increasingly parts of our cities have been privatised, enclosed. The old, you know, what we used to do in the fields back hundreds of years ago was to privatise and take over the fields, so people had to then move out of the fields. The same exact thing is going on, enclosure in our cities, private shopping centres, things like this. Now it's all our ordinary police don't have any jurisdiction in there. It's only the private police that will do something. And just remember what your legal rights are. Anywhere which is an actual public place, that is to say a public street, rather than a shopping centre or a private street, as a lot of our streets have been privatised, you're perfectly entitled to film absolutely anything you can see. And if anyone tries to stop you, whether they're the police or anybody else, they're overstepping the law.
I think we've got to really be worried about the privatisation of security, full stop.
Mm.
Schiphol Airport, where the so-called underpants bomber got on the plane not last Christmas, but the Christmas before. That is controlled. The whole security in the airport is controlled by a private Israeli company whose name I've forgotten. Now, this is a real problem. Because I mentioned Veritas Systems in relation to the London Underground. When people get on the London Underground train, if they're being photographed, they ought to be able to know that that is actually being done by London Underground or by London Underground Police or whatever. Once you've got private security companies in there, like Blackwater, whoever it is, the potential for abuse is enormous, really enormous, to the extent where terrorism could even be committed by these companies. That's the sort of thing that is being suspected.
Coming back to Steve... Steve Jolly, a local activist from Birmingham. You've been invited to the House of Commons, I believe, for a review of the Freedom Bill, is that correct?
Yeah, I had a call a couple of weeks ago to invite me to give oral evidence to the Protection of Freedoms Bill committee hearing. They're drawing up new regulation for CCTV and AMPR cameras. And they're really selling this as a wonderful thing. So they're saying, "Oh, this is great! We're going to restore your liberty and your privacy, and we're going to make sure that nobody's got any problems or issues or complaints about CCTV."
Could you give us a brief overview of this Freedom Bill?
not really. I'm really just more interested in the aspects that relate to the surveillance cameras. I've looked at the code of practice, and it's quite shocking, really, because it's being marketed as this really good idea that's going to give us loads of freedoms, and there's going to be no sort of intrusive snooping, and we'll have all these rights. And a lot of journalists are just churning this out as a wonderful thing and saying, great step in the right direction. But if you actually look at the detail, and the devil is always in the detail, if you drill down, there's nothing really in the bill about CCTV. There is attached, right at the end somewhere, an appendix, is this code of practice. Well, basically, the stated aim of this code of practice relating to CCTV and other forms of camera surveillance is to increase the effectiveness of CCTV and to ensure that the public does not lose confidence in it. So really, it's nothing to do with freedom. It's about promoting CCTV. It's about pushing
it's
more
about
and more
perception,
surveillance.
Isn't it? It's about how people perceive those cameras up there.
Yeah, I mean, there was an MP,
a bit of good PR,
Philip Davis MP, who was commenting on the Project Champion spy cameras here in Birmingham, and he said, "Well, if we put them everywhere, then nobody will feel as if they're being picked on as a group or as a community." So it would be fair then. So you are actually getting people saying, "Well, why don't we just put them on every lamppost, and then no one will feel that they're sort of either hard done by, either because they haven't got CCTV or because they've got too much of it." But that is the sort of society we're moving towards, unfortunately. And the thing that's allowing it is this public support, which is, in my view, largely manufactured. It's been created over the last 15 years, and now if you ask the average person on the street, you've struggled to find people who really got a strong view on it, but most people give it the thumbs up and think, where's the harm? It's fine. It's a good thing, surely. Catches bad guys.
Well, I don't know if anyone remembers the series called The Prisoner from the 1960s, but it's one of my favourite sort of cult TV series of mine. And, I mean, in that series, what you've got there is a former spy who tries to resign from his job, but his bosses don't actually like the fact that he's resigned because he's got too much in his head, and so he gets taken to a place called The Village. And The Village is in fact a prison. It's just, it seems normal, and you know what, on every street corner there's a little camera. And this series was made back in 1968 1969. And I would thoroughly recommend it as a laugh, as well as being a lot of political insight from all that time ago. And that's the one thing that I find really eerie about that series, is if you look at it, actually, that village is a prison, and it's characterised by a CCTV camera on every corner.
And that, Tony, that is what we're doing to Britain. That, in my view, we're creating a sort of open prison where everyone's free to come and go as they please, provided they're on video surveillance and they're being tracked and recorded.
You are the proverbial camel on a leash, so to speak. Yeah.
Well, it's one of the people they're all called by numbers in the village, is number six and number two. Number one at one point says, "My hope is the whole world like the village." But it's done in a jokey way, but actually a lot of it has been very prophetic and has actually come to pass.
Well, it are. I mean, with all the cameras that we got on our streets and nowadays, I mean, just goes to show.
Well, a lot of the stuff that you see in what you might call science fiction is just sort of foreshadowing what's to come.
This is a fascinating topic in itself, I must say. Because, you know, I mean, we're just about a minute away from the break. But this is something I often think about myself that is true. If you read a lot of early H.G. Wells and other famous sci-fi authors, it is bizarre. Some of the things that Side has told me, and I'll get into chipping it at some point later in the show, some of the bizarre things that are going on would really blow people's heads away. But like I said, we are very close to the break now. If you want to call us after the break, it's 0121-772-8892. We have with us in the studio live Tony Gosling and Martin Summers from Bristol City FM, the BCFM Friday Drive Time program, and you can listen to that live, or you can listen to the listen again every week on www.thisweek.org.uk. Like I said, with us we have Tony Gosling and Martin Summers from Bristol City FM. I'd like to talk to Tony about some economic woe.
Well, before we do that, if it's all right, Tariq, I'd like to just pick up on something that Steve was talking about there, which is this whole business of biometrics. Now, biometrics is to do with these surveillance cameras. It's also it's basically a way of measuring part. I mean, this is what it means. Bio is your body or biology, and then metrics is measuring. So the idea is that biometrics is a new science which is becoming a massive industry to actually take pictures of our faces, our fingerprints, etc., and build up databases on everybody. And I'm finding this a little bit worrying. And I know, Steve, just during the break there, you were mentioning that this is actually something almost from science fiction.
Yeah, but it's happening. I mean, we've all seen the movies where, you know, a camera will scan somebody's face or their iris and know everything about them. And, you know, we watch these movies and we think of it as fiction. But it often foreshadows what's to come. And sure enough, facial recognition seems to be starting to come into the real world now.
Well, I mean, is it not true that I think some very, very big internet providers, I think Google and other people, are actually starting to use this facial recognition?
Everyone is gagging for it. I mean, I've heard it described as, you know, the new dot-com bubble. Mm. Everyone is trying to develop the best, most reliable, effective facial recognition software.
If I could just say, actually, a lot of the software that's been developed is not actually that wonderful.
That's true.
Because I don't know if you've seen some of these pictures, but what happens is that as you're walking past a camera, it will send an image of you, but basically automatically slice out a little bit of that image, which is your face, and then send it for interrogation to another part of the system. The only trouble is, halfway along the line, it has to figure out, you know, basically match you to an existing database of faces. What it quite often does now, apparently, is to actually get the head upside down, so that if you're someone who's bald with a beard, you quite often get the whole face upside down, so it attaches it to somebody.
Actually, if I'm a chip in here, guys, another worrying fact, actually, again on the lines of CCTV, I was looking at an article on Blacklisted News yesterday about, you know, how we have the body scanners in airport. Well, now there is...
Oh, this is the TSA or something in the United States, isn't it?
There is a story going around the body scanning system. They want to implement it on railway stations and even talks about it on public roads.
It's shocking, isn't it? Once you get into this area of inquiry and start researching into this sort of state intrusion, there seems no end to it.
It seems that there's a massive database as well. It clearly is happening. It's the National ID database. It's being built up. This is the thing that the ID cards were supposed to match up to, but now we've got rid of the ID card, at least that as a possibility. You do wonder, well, since all these databases are there and they're being built up, do they really need a card?
Well, I think that the card... was getting rid of the identity card was a publicity stunt to say, you civil libertarians, look, you've won, you know, we've got a new government and we really care about
thought that was great. I was cheering when they said they weren't going to do it.
They're still grabbing the data. They're still storing the data. They want, it's the data they want. Getting rid of the cards is neither here nor there. They can just shrug and go, well, we won't do it yet. We'll do it later, maybe. But it's the data they're after. So I don't think they've really given up anything. The state's still at it.
If I could just chip in from picking up on Side's point, I mean, the original incident which caused the TSA to be set up and all of these searches to be going on in America was this underpants bomb incident of two Christmases ago. And we've got eyewitnesses, Kurt Haskell and Laurie Haskell, who were on the plane, and several other witnesses saying that the actual bomber was taken onto the plane without going through any security checks at all, because the security staff themselves are implicated in the bombing, potential bombing. He didn't even have a passport.
He had a handler.
Yeah, he had a handler who got him onto the plane. Now, what people have got to realise is if the people in charge were honourable people, I might trust them with some powers of surveillance. But if the people in charge are, in fact, the terrorists or potential terrorists, then they shouldn't be given any kind of power over us at all. And I think, from my point of view, the balance has got to be struck. You do need a police force in society. You do need some kind of surveillance of things which need to be surveyed, airports and so on. But we've really got to ask the question, the fundamental question, is why have we got a terrorist problem and who are the terrorists? And, of course, that's a very big question. We'll probably be coming back to that later in the programme. And you've covered these kind of issues before. But I think people really need to wake up and understand that the Big Brother is not necessarily your friend.
And certainly not, you know, even at school. This is one of the things that bothers me, is bringing these kind of technologies into schools is almost conditioning young people to to accept these kind of biometric technology for life. Now, I don't know if anyone here is familiar with the way that these technologies can be used in schools, because I know there's fingerprint systems used for library lending and dinner tickets in some schools.
Just recently, last year, we had one of the local schools, Queensbridge School, implemented biometric fingerprinting. And I don't have children, so I'm not a parent of anyone at the school, so I don't know quite how it was implemented. Some letters went out, but this is
the practicality would be rather strange. I mean, fingerprinting children, especially if they were young children.
It comes down to, I think it really, we've lost sight of gut instincts and first principles.
We fingerprint criminals.
Exactly.
Not innocent kids.
We're not 5-year-olds.
Arguing over the minutiae of details as to whether something is or isn't justified. You know, and when really we should know instinctively if something's wrong.
I totally agree.
Would you not say that's some kind of a human rights violation, some privacy?
Well, I think, it is in my view, and I think Tony was spot on when he said that it's really what it's doing is conditioning young children to accept the ubiquitous nature of surveillance of one form or another. So, you know, there are schools that have facial recognition software on cameras to they say it's about lateness and truancy. You know, they give similar arguments for fingerprints.
That's a very, very worrying argument.
We had a similar situation. I mean, not in the UK, but just over a year and a half ago. Again, we covered it on the show as well about cameras on laptop computers, which were issued at a school in the United States.
Yeah.
And kids actually took those laptops home. Of course, these laptops were actually monitored by the school. And what these laptops were doing, as the laptops were left switched on, they were actually monitoring the kids actually getting changed, getting into bed, and all sorts of things.
Yeah, I read that story. The built-in webcams were being accessed remotely over the internet by the school. That's absolutely shocking.
Well, something I've heard also is that webcams, I mean, I would always advise anybody who uses webcams to make sure that they're actually unplugged or switched off when you're not using, because they can be prone to viruses in the same way a computer can.
Well, look, Terry, the trouble is a lot of laptops now come with one just built in, don't they?
Yes, yeah, I have a laptop with a built-in camera, and of course, if a virus gets in there, if you know one of these hackers decides to hack into your webcam, which they can do, they could potentially be watching you without your knowing.
Yeah, a bit of sticky tape should sort that out, though. but yeah, most people wouldn't occur to them that might be possible.
Well, I can tell you something. I actually sat down, this is about 5-6 years ago, with an investigative journalist who'd been at hackers' conferences, and he was looking at actually what you can do as a hacker. And I was pretty shocked to see what he could do. Basically, he had two or three fake personalities using fake names. Two of them were girls, and he was going on to police chat forums and actually getting real police to chat with him, thinking he was a woman. And then he was starting to go into their, once he realized who the person was, he was able to actually use a bit of software to get into their laptop to get into their computer and start finding out what was on their hard drive. He then even said, look, if I want to, watch this, I can take over control of their mouse.
Very good piece of application.
And this is literally just starting with an internet relay chat connection. And then once he'd identified their IP address, he used another bit of software to be in the background actually hacking into that person's computer. Now, this technology is out there for an investigative journalist and for hackers. You can be absolutely sure it's out there for police and security services and private security too.
I want to move on now, actually get back to, obviously, you know, we've got cameras all over the place. Where's the money? That's the question. And on that note, of course, you know, we come to the situation of, you know, the current banking situation, the economic situation that we've been, you know, going through in the last 2, 3 to 4 years now. The banks are not lending as much anymore, Tony.
Well, yes, you've managed to finally persuade me to get off the subject of cameras and talk about the financial crisis. Okay. Now, I've just got a hold of the copy of The Eye today, which is this kind of 20p cheap newspaper. I mean, as a journalist, I'd thoroughly recommend it, actually. I think it's quite an interesting new development in the way newspapers operate. It's almost laid out like a tabloid paper. It only costs 20 pence a day. And actually, it's got a pretty good compilation of most of the sort of news that would be in a little bit of the tabloid press, but mainly the broadsheet papers, what used to be called the broadsheets anyway, like the Times, the Guardian, and it's actually produced by the Independent. I think it's the sort of thing, if I have to buy a paper quickly during the day, definitely pick it up. You can easily scan the stories. And today we hear that high street sales are dwindling as shoppers stop spending. This is James Thompson in The Eye. Retailers suffered their weakest sales growth for nearly 2 years last month as hard-pressed shoppers reined in their spending because of soaring petrol prices, tax increases and uncertainty about jobs. Well, those petrol prices, if we're looking at what's going on in the Middle East and North Africa, may be soaring even more over the next few months. And I'd kind of like to just put this to Martin that this does look, appears near here from these figures, that we clearly are in a double-dip recession, just as we thought at the end of the last Labour government, beginning middle of last year, that actually the economy was picking up. It seems pretty clear now it's heading down again as people just simply aren't spending in the high streets.
Well, that's right, because we've just the government themselves say we're going to lose 500,000 public sector jobs and 600,000 private sector jobs. Everybody's terrified of the future, and therefore they're not spending their saving, which is inevitably going to happen. I mean, whoever had won the election, what they needed to do was steer the British ship, the British economy as a ship, in such a way, because there was going to be a tsunami anyway from outside. The banking collapse in the US or a war in the Middle East was obviously a likely event. And what they should have been doing is making sure that the ship was bow on to that wave. But by cutting public expenditure in the way they have, they've now made sure that we're side on to the wave, so it'll have maximum impact when it hits. And when we say double dip recession, that sounds like, oh, well, we've had one dip, and there'll be just a return into another dip. What this really means is we fall off the edge of the cliff now. We've been teetering on the edge of the cliff, being propped up by government intervention. That's no longer going to be the case, and now we fall off the cliff.
So is,
and
is
that, where's the bottom of the cliff? Nobody knows.
So is George Osborne, our Chancellor, is he incompetent, or is this deliberate?
It suits various people's interests. The oil companies are
You saying it's deliberate, then?
Well,
whose interest does it serve?
He is incompetent, because he ought to know better. But don't forget that there are vested interests here. The oil companies, for example, are the ones who are forcing up the oil price. It suits their book. They're making money out of it. The hedge funds are betting on a crash. They will make money if there is a crash. So there is a sort of there's a series of vested interests who don't really care about the overall health of the economy. They're looking after themselves, and those people are in charge of the policy directly and indirectly. Osborne really is let's face it, he's a low level operative. He gets told what to do and he does it. It's the City of London who write his script.
Because I mean, it does occur to me that politicians seem to be keeping their eye on the markets day after day after day and actually jumping to the tune of the markets, trying to make to satisfy the markets, to make sure that they're stable.
Well,
we only get a vote once every four years.
Yes, but the Guardian pointed out the other day that 50% of the Conservative Party's money comes from the City of London.
And the other 50% comes from big businesses.
Yes, that are not in the City of London.
Yes.
I mean, the problem is that there's the electorate, and then there's the people who pay for politics. And the people who pay are often more influential than the voters.
I remember reading something quite interesting a few months back. It was in the newsletter Private Eye. Ed Miliband, of course, who is a new Labour leader, in the background, he's privately being somewhat harassed by Sainsbury, or Lord Sainsbury, as he refers to himself. In fact, he's actually... I can't remember the name of this particular think tank that Lord Sainsbury has put together. I think it's called Progress or something like that. Mm-hmm. But this think tank is effectively saying to Ed Miliband that you need to be supporting big business, okay? It's a very, very important thing. Or effectively, if you don't support big business and the kind of corporate structure that we like, then we will effectively will be cutting off your allowance in no uncertain terms.
Yeah, but I mean, that's why, I mean, the Labour Party traditionally has been funded by the trade unions in previous generations.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that's been under attack. I mean, the government will try and prevent that from, the current government will try and undermine that. I mean, in the US, we've seen the attack on the public sector unions in Wisconsin, which has led to a mass response. I mean, ultimately, money talks in politics. The Supreme Court in the US has now decided that corporations can give any amount of money to political campaigns, and they don't even have to tell what they're doing. There's no transparency even. We're not even allowed to know who's given the money. And this, of course, is totally rigging the system against the ordinary citizen.
Just buy your own president.
Yes, buy your own president, and that's what we've got.
Are we not heading in a similar direction here, Martin? Because from what I can see, you know, from what I see, even on mainstream television, it seems that our political parties these days are effectively bankrolled.
Well, they are. I mean, what's interesting is in Scandinavian countries like Sweden or Finland or Norway, they realised that this was a problem in the 1930s, and they brought in legislation for basically state funding of political parties. So each BN system gets a proportion of the money depending on how many votes they got at the last election, and that's all they can spend. They're not allowed to raise any more money anywhere else. And that means that it's much more level playing field, and they get a much more sensible debate. But we are now reaching the point where we're saying that people with money can buy politicians and the political process, and we're not going to try and control that. I think that's obviously why we got in, that's why the policies are wrong, because they're not being determined by the interests of the majority, they're being determined by the interests of the wealthy minority.
But hang on a minute, Martin, because the Liberal Democrat Party, the Conservative Party and the Labour Party are all democratic political parties. The policies are not made by the City of London, they're made by the members of those parties.
Well, you're playing devil's advocate there, because it's still when you come
at least to, that's what's supposed to happen.
No, but when it comes to an election campaign and the other side have got three, four, five times the amount of money you've got, it's like saying Liverpool is a football team and so is
Manchester United, perhaps, or something.
Well, Manchester United is a bad example. I'm thinking of another small football team in Birmingham.
Swansea.
Cradley Heath Juniors or whatever. Mm. They're both football teams, but Liverpool are going to beat them every time, aren't they? Because they can buy the top players and the other side can't.
Well, yes, indeed. And the other thing is that the banks who are bankrolling these political parties, well, they're not bankrolling us, are they, Tony?
No, they're bankrolling themselves. Mm. I mean, this is another piece on the same page from the Eye today. Britain's bankers are mounting their fight back. This is Outlook by David Prosser. If you think the value of Bob Diamond's bonus package for 2010 at £6.5 million, I thought we were reducing the bankers' bonuses, but obviously not, is a sign that Barclays has heeded calls for restraint. He was, after all, tipped for a £10 million payday. Take a look at the rest of the detail on remuneration provided by the bank. Now, this is Barclays, who was not part of this massive bailout and is still a private independent bank. Quite whether they're solvent or not, Martin might be able to enlighten us later.
None of them are solvent.
So, anyway, the bank actually, there's a total of £39 million going out to their top executives. So not a lot of restraint there. But the thing that really shocked me about this short article by David Prosser was that the difference between the amount of profit that Barclays made and the amount they paid in tax. Now, £113 million is the corporation tax they paid in 2009. But can anybody guess what actual profit they made? So, bearing in mind, you know, that this is a sort of, you know, maybe 20% or something the corporation tax should be of their profits, their actual profits were £4.6 billion. So, we're talking about something like one let's just work this out in my head quickly, is about a thousandth of their profits was paid in tax. Now, that is a tiny, tiny figure. What's that? 0.1% of their profits paid in tax. So how on earth can Barclays be only paying that kind of rate of tax when we are paying massive more than that in income tax?
Well, we could pay them in a deficit with that, couldn't we?
It's because the George Osborne and those sorts of policy-making politicians, when they go to make these corporate tax policies, who is it who advises them what those policies should be? It's people like CEOs of big corporations and banks. Those are the people who are making these corporate tax policies for their own benefit.
Can I just come back to this question of solvency? What people haven't realised is that the banks, during the banking crisis of 2 years ago, the banks were allowed to take all the junk that they'd got in that they'd collected over the years, and they were allowed to market into their balance sheets at full price. Yeah, so they bought this stuff off various other people. You know, they've been buying and selling it from each other, and they've been allowed to put that in as full price assets. So the profits that they're pretending to show are based on the idea that all their assets are actually at full price. But if they were made to mark those assets to market, in other words, if they were trying to sell those assets, they would get a fraction of the cover price. So in actual fact, there are no profits in the banks. This is what's called in the technical term, it's a control fraud. The people running the bank are basically running the bank for their own interest, and ultimately the banks will bust, but they will walk away with the money.
Yeah, it's like Enron accounting.
Enron accounting, exactly. Enron accounting is clearly what it's about.
Yeah, but hang on a minute. These banks are all audited.
No, they're not properly audited. They've been allowed, they've used the political power that they've got through the money that they've stolen. So they steal the money, they buy the politicians then agree to turn a blind eye to what they're doing, and nothing gets done. I mean, Joe Stiglitz used to head the World Bank, and James Galbraith, who's Kenneth Galbraith's son, who's a famous economist, saying, unless we see senior executives in the United States go to prison, we are never going to restore faith in the financial system.
Strong words.
Absolutely.
It's a Wall Street government, though, isn't it?
It is a Wall Street government, and it's not going to happen, but a lot of what's gone on is, in fact, fraud.
Absolutely.
There's no doubt about it. And people, I was reading earlier on the internet, some guy said, if we sent Lloyd Blankfein, the head of Goldman Sachs, to prison, you know, a serious prison for 6 months, a lot of these people, you know, because they're not deterred by fines. You know, they negotiate the fines. We've stolen 20 billion, we'll pay you a billion in fines, then we're still 19 billion ahead. But if you're going to be sent to prison, then that could be a deterrent. And in the 1980s, during the savings and loans scandal, 3,000 top executives were sent to prison.
Well, Bernie Madoff was put in prison, wasn't he?
Yeah, but he stole from wealthy people.
Yeah.
He stole from other wealthy people. That was a bad mistake. He should have stuck to stealing from poor people.
Just to also chip in here, we've heard this week also that HSBC are spreading rumours, which they are not actually scotching, that they may be actually moving. This is, I think, isn't it short for Hong Kong Shanghai Banking Corporation,
yes.
HSBC, another still private, not government or public-owned bank in Britain, nationalised bank, are threatening to actually pull out of the UK. So poor old George Osborne is biting his nails, doing these little deals, the Merlin deals with the bankers, and then they're saying, look, if we don't like what you're doing, we're actually just going to move our headquarters out of Britain.
Well, these banks that are saying that they're not bought out by the government, the whole banking system has been propped up by the government, yeah? Because don't forget, HSBC is owed a lot of money by RBS, which was bought out by the government. So when they say that they're not covered by the government's guarantee, that's wrong. All of the banking system is ultimately covered by the government's guarantee. Now, we've either got a free market system where people take risks and if they fail, they take the hit, or we've got a planned system where we have a plan. But we've actually got the worst of both worlds. We've got private profits, and when they make a loss, the society picks up the tab. And as Mervyn King from the Bank of England, good to see what he's been saying the last few weeks, you know, he's been saying, look, this just can't go on. We've got a bankrupt system which is being bailed out by the taxpayer, and that just encourages them to thieve more. And the City of London has been very, very angry about what Mervyn King has been saying, because he was saying, you know, people should be angry. You know, this is all wrong. And I think he's a civil servant, and he's actually telling people what they ought to hear. But the government aren't happy with what he's saying either. I wonder how long he's going to last.
Well, indeed. You can always, for more information like this, I would recommend two websites. One is called Positive Money. If you Google that, I think it's www.positivemoney.org.uk, if I'm correct. And also another website called One Good Cuts. We played their video a few weeks back on our show, And these two websites very elaborately explain the whole banking system, how it currently works through YouTube videos and on their web pages. And they're also running various campaigns as well. Ben Curtis, who's, I believe, been on Tony and Martin's show in the
past
as well.
That's
right, yep. We are, again, heading shortly to a break again. Just like to mention, today we do have Tony Gosling and Martin Summers live in the studio from Bristol City FM. That's BCFM. You can listen to their show every week via www.thisweek.org. You can either listen live from 5 to 7pm every Friday, or there's a listen again link and you can download the shows as well. We've got local activist Steve Jolly with us as well, and we also, myself, Saeed and Humain, are also in the studio. You can call us on 0121 772 8892. You can send us messages on Facebook, on our Facebook page Behind the Headlines as well, so please do join that page and post your comments on there as well.
Finally, on the banking, just do remember, we've had this Project Merlin thing, which is rather limp, been organised by Osborne. But do remember, later in the year, there is the Independent Commission on Banking, which may possibly break up some of our banks, some of our private banks. We shall see. Martin, any prediction on whether that will happen?
Well, I don't think it's very likely, but it could, I realise we're going to the break. But, I mean, Mervyn King has been talking about some of the positive money ideas. So the government of the Bank of England has been picking up on some of the ideas on those websites.
Maybe he's been listening to our show.
Maybe. Do please join us for after this short break. We'll be back with more.
Tony Godley. Good evening, Tony.
Oh, yeah.
Martin Summers. And, of course, Stephen Jolly and myself, Tariq.
Just like to mention, of course, although sure regular listeners know that, you know, Tony and Martin are from Bristol City FM.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Who've actually won a prize from
Bristol
Sony.
Community FM.
Sorry, Bristol Community FM. You see, this is how bad, you know, and how uninformed I do apologise. But, Martin, just quickly, I mean, you've won an award from Sony. Tell us more about that.
Well, we've won the award for the best small station.
It's the best small radio station in the southwest, which is actually a pretty good award.
We're quite pleased.
Quite a lot of the local smaller local BBC stations, like the Channel Island stations, and there's there's around about 100 community stations all across the southwest, and we got number one prize. So.
And we're going to the national final, so we're on our way to Wembley.
Despite Martin and I and our show, they managed to get the prize.
Fantastic. Well, congratulations to Bristol Community FM.
Well done.
For winning that award. And yes, absolutely. Well done to you guys.
And we're going listening. On. Well, we're actually going on now in the second round to the national competition in Sony. So we'll see if we get anywhere there.
Well, best of luck for that, you know. So, you know,
absolutely.
Please do support, you know, BCFM by listening on www.bcfm.org.uk. There's a variety, a plethora of different shows on there. And you can catch Martin and Tony every Friday from 5 till 7pm with the Drive Time Show, which is the State of the City report.
The other thing, of course, we have a lot on our station. Bristol is absolutely teeming with musicians. We've got actually a larger proportion of musicians who are getting their receipts from PRS. This is the people that distribute the money for records that are played on the radio and in clubs and that sort of thing. We've got a higher proportion of people on PRS in Bristol than any other city in the country. So we're a very musical place, and a lot of musicians say that they actually come to Bristol to meet other musicians, to meet, sort of get music going, of fusions between different cultures, because we've got a very multicultural city, and so we like to think that we are able to pull our weight as regards the national music scene.
Moving on, if you want to talk to Tony, Martin, or Steve, or any of us, actually, give us a shout, 0121 772 8892. Also, if you don't want to come on the phone, you're a bit shy, you know, it's just us, so don't worry about it. Just drop us a text, 07926 843388, 07926 843388, or drop us a comment on our Facebook page. And on with the show, down to business, as they say in the trade.
Yeah, we'd just like to talk to Martin now. Of course, over the last few weeks, Libya has absolutely dominated the news for various reasons. Perhaps you could bring us up to date now with the most recent kind of happenings in Libya as it stands. So,
I mean, obviously, people will be following this on the mainstream media and they'll be aware of what's going on. I mean, obviously, the big story in the last 2 days has been this special forces squad, SAS or SBS, being captured by the Libyan rebels. And you know, basically returned to Britain with a flea in their ear and told not to cause trouble. But what I'd just like to pick up on here is that the Libyan authorities, and when I say the Libyan authorities here, we're talking about the rebels rather than the Gaddafi regime. They are quite clear, and it's been covered in all the media, that this squad of people were carrying explosives, not guns. They were carrying guns, but also explosives. And I'd ask the listeners to consider for a minute, if there is any non-sinister reason why these guys should have been carrying explosives. explosives off of blowing things up.
Well, we were being told, of course, that they were there to guard two diplomats. They were
on their way to a meeting. Squad. I mean, I think basically people should treat the British government's story about this with a pinch of salt, because they also said that these people were diplomats, and it's turned out that they're actually MI6 officers. So they've already been caught out lying about this. The British government has issued no statement or comment about the fact that they were carrying false passports, guns and explosives. And what it reminds me of very strongly is what happened in Basra a few years ago, if the listeners will remember, when those two guys dressed as locals were arrested after shooting their way through a roadblock, were arrested by the local police in Basra, and they were carrying guns and explosives. And you have to ask yourself, where are two SAS guys going in Basra with a car full of explosives? What are they going to do? And of course, the suspicion has to be that they are involved in some kind of false flag terrorism, that they're going to bomb a mosque and blame it on somebody else, for example. And we've got a similar situation in Pakistan now, where this chap, so-called chap Raymond Davis, or at least that's what they're calling him. Mm. I thought Ray Davis was the front man for the Kinks, but apparently he's turned up in Pakistan. The Pakistani authorities are saying in their pronouncements, and it's all over the English language media in Pakistan, that this guy has not only shot two people dead at a traffic lights and his colleagues run somebody else over, but that he had his mobile phone records show him in contact with all of the top terrorist groups inside Pakistan. And it's widely suspected by people in Pakistan that the United States is running a cover war against Pakistani society and against the Pakistani state, involving, for example, no warning bombs in mosques, which are blamed on Islamic extremists. But you're actually, the suspicion is that this is actually being orchestrated from outside. Now, some people in this country would probably find that shocking and hard to believe. I suspect a lot of people from Pakistan don't find that shocking or hard to believe. They know very well that this is the kind of things that go on.
Now, Martin, just one little thing is that one of the reports that came out about Raymond Davis, who's still in custody in Pakistan, the Americans desperately want him back. The Pakistanis believe that he actually may be shot just to keep him quiet.
Yes.
There are Russian intelligence reports that came out about 2-3 weeks ago that he was actually peddling nuclear material and biological weapons to Al-Qaeda in Pakistan. Now, just putting that forward as an allegation, do you think there's any chance that the Russians are right?
Well, I mean, the Russians obviously are playing, if they're saying that, that's because they want us to know about it. Now, they may be playing their own game. But at the same time, the idea that he might be passing, what I would suggest might be happening there, is he is setting up terrorist groups in Pakistan to get the blame for a nuclear or chemical attack inside the United States, but it won't be those groups that will carry it out. It'll be carried out separately, but they've been set up to get the blame because he's handing them documentation about it, so that it puts them in the frame.
Because it sounds unbelievable, doesn't it, really? But I mean, could there be a possible motive? You've just pointed out that maybe this is kind of evidence planting that he's doing.
Yeah, but I mean, people who listen to this show, I'm sure, will be familiar with the concept of false flag terrorism, the idea that you do something to make somebody else look bad. In particular, the whole setting up of the Muslim community to be, you know, the enemy within, and so on.
So the idea is a sort of planting a flag on an event that actually is the different flag from the flag that it actually carries.
So we've got the two SAS boys that were arrested in Basra, and then the British reacted by storming the police station and freeing them, which allowed hundreds of other inmates to escape. Yeah, they were really concerned that these guys should not be properly interrogated, which really raises the question mark about what they were doing. Now, if we suspect that this kind of thing is going on within the United States, possibly within our own country on 7/7, then the idea that they may do it in Iraq or Libya is not at all far-fetched, is it? I mean, if people are prepared to blow up London Underground, they're prepared to blow up something in Libya to create an incident.
Also, you say, Martin, that these people were the British and the Americans that are fighting for Raymond Davis. I mean, that's also been on the news, but the British were fighting, storming the station to actually get these SAS boys released. Doesn't that go to show that even if these false flag terrorism, I mean, the SAS are above the law of interrogation in a country that they committed those crimes in?
Well, if they were caught, then the question arises, doesn't it? I mean, the Pakistani authorities are refusing to release Ray Davis. They're refusing to release him because, I mean, the guy's shot two people at a traffic light.
Potentially, Pakistani intelligence agency shot.
Oh, well, it may be that he was being followed by Pakistani intelligence agents who were onto what he was up to, which is why he shot them. That's one of the things that's being suspected. I mean, this is all speculation, but I think what we can be clear about is the possibility that the SAS in particular are involved in these kind of activities is not at all unbelievable. I've got in front of me here a book called The Nemesis File, The True Story of an SAS Execution Quad by Paul Bruce. I'll just read you a bit of the blurb off the back. Paul Bruce was a tough, idealistic young trooper in the SAS when he was dispatched to Northern Ireland. His top secret mission, to execute suspects in cold blood. Bruce and three SAS comrades shot dead down one terrified victim after another, leaving their bodies to be buried in deep, unmarked woodland graves. The soldiers grew their hair long, drove ordinary-looking cars, but they always carried pistols and submachine guns. In this historic book, the author produces maps to show where his victims lie secretly buried. He also chronicles the mental breakdown of crack SAS troops ordered to carry out the dirtiest job in a secret war. And the Sunday Times here says, a tale of mass murder and random street assassinations. Now, this is all historical document. This isn't conspiracy theory. This guy was doing this, Paul Bruce.
I think the good thing to say about that, Martin, if there's anything good, is that he obviously had a conscience and he decided to make sure it was all down on the record.
Speaking of consciences, there was a very good ex-SAS trooper called... you know the name of the person I'm thinking of?
Andy McNabb.
No.
Brian.
No, the chap that's spoken out against the abuse.
Like Ben Griffin.
Ben Griffin is an ex-SAS soldier, and he has come out. He's on YouTube. He's been silenced now under the Official Secrets Act, but he's on YouTube speaking at a meeting in London, and he says, "I'm an ex-SAS guy. We are involved in the kidnappings, the assassinations and the tortures, and we know what's going on, and it's all completely wrong, it's all against the Geneva Convention," and he has come out and denounced it. Now, I wouldn't accuse the SAS as an institution of all being entirely wrong, but on the other hand, we know in the past that they have been used in this kind of way. We know, for example, I'm involved in Colombian activity. We suspect that SAS chaps may have been involved in assassinations in Colombia on behalf of BP. In Casanare. And I'm afraid the idea that the British Special Forces and the US Special Forces might be involved in these kind of nefarious activities is not conspiracy theory. In the past, we know this happened. Well, the question is it still going on?
Martin, the British Foreign Secretary, William Hague, has taken responsibility for this SAS operation in Libya, the botched operation.
Well, he's just taking responsibility for the fact that it failed. What worries me is these guys were carrying explosives. I'll go back to my initial point. What were they going to do with those explosives? What were they going to do with them?
Well, I mean, anyone with a bit of common sense would know. I mean, if you're going to protect some diplomat, guns, usually you carry, but explosive.
There's only one use for explosives. That's for blowing things up.
Absolutely.
The other thing is, I wonder if you think this is an operation, the botched operation last Friday, that came out in the press over the weekend, which would have had to have been signed off by David Cameron.
It was signed off by David Cameron. Hague's taking the blame, but they're apparently carrying a letter from David. They say they were carrying a letter from David Cameron to the rebel leadership. I have my doubts whether they were on a mission to talk to the rebel leadership, because as various people pointed out, there are phones working in Benghazi. They could have just phoned them up and got it, or just come on. I mean, apparently the Dutch have flown in and flown their people out. The planes are still flying in and out of Benghazi, so there's absolutely no reason to sneak in there in the dead of night in a helicopter. I suspect that what they were doing was infiltrating Libya to do something, we don't know what, something with those explosives.
So is this a suggestion of sabotage, potentially?
Yeah, I think that, don't forget that what may have been happening in Basra, that these guys are going to blow something up and blame it on somebody else. That's what we suspect.
Can I just sort of throw a question out randomly to our panel, if you like, Tony, Steve or Martin here, actually. Who do you think these rebels are, in reality, and who are these supposedly pro-Gaddafi people?
Well, I think they're people who've had a hard time from Gaddafi over many years. I don't think there's any... it's controversial to say that Gaddafi's secret police were one of the most feared organisations across North Africa and the Middle East.
On that note, we've just got a caller. Caller's called in to, obviously, discuss this. We'd like to welcome this caller. Hello?
Hello?
Hello, yes, you're live on the air, caller.
Hello, brother. I just wanted to make a point you were on about... I was listening to the radio and I heard about... You saw on about explosives and this and that. There's a program I watched on YouTube. It's called 77 The Ripple Effect.
Very good documentary, yeah.
Mm.
It shows you what really happened at the 7/7 bombings and how the British government has just lied and about everything and covered it all up. It's called a 7/7 conspiracy, the ripple effect.
And well, actually, I mean, I think the person who made that documentary you're talking about, he made a previous documentary about September the 11th as well. That documentary...
But this one, you got to see the evidence.
Well, yes, I mean... What you got is you got people who are actually professionals. You got air pilots and all sorts of people. It is indeed a very worthwhile documentary watching.
I just want to say, yeah, the biggest terrorists are Tony Blair and George Bush. And Tony Blair, George Bush, biggest terrorists.
Okay, well, thank you very much. That was a very interesting call there.
That's true. I mean, expressing
his opinions.
The guy who made the ripple effect, who was his pseudonym was Murray Dibb, wasn't it? I mean, he's actually being held in. Is he not? He's going to be extradited from Ireland.
It's a court case which is dragged on and on.
Yeah.
But I mean, I'd like to flag up something I think, from production values and TV point of view, as actually even better documentary and more concise than The Ripple Effect, which is one called Ludicrous Diversion.
I think we should also plug. Mind the Gap, which we were involved in, which we think was the best one.
Well, I don't actually know, because it's got that transvestite David Shaler, person who went...
Just because David Shaler was in the front of Mind the Gap, I think that was actually... I mean, we helped to make that
it's
film.
It's to taint it.
So, Corner, we are very aware of what happened on 7/7, and as British people, we are very, very disconcerned to get to the bottom of it.
And what shocks me more than anything about the whole 7/7 business, which I've been quite deeply involved with doing several reports on it, is the fact that it's almost nothing of the real problems with that have made it into the mainstream press. We've just had a protracted, I think it was in October, it's about 5 month inquest into the 7/7 bombings. And really, I don't think that any of the major serious questions, the lack of evidence, the lack of CCTV evidence to put these guys on those trains at the time, as well as the another thing, which is the lack of evidence of the actual types of explosives which were used. Mm. Certainly, if you look at the damage that was caused and the number of people that died, it looks like military explosives, and yet we're told that these bombs were made up in baths up in Leeds.
Yeah.
Can I just, I mean, I just agree with what you're saying there, but I was just wanted to mention the title of that film, Ludicrous Diversion, and why it was called that. It was because Tony Blair took it upon himself to decide that there need not be any inquiry, and it's only happened recently, but this...
Yes, he said it would be a ludicrous diversion to have an inquiry.
Yeah, he said it would basically take us away from the real work that we need to get involved in, which is the war on terror. So, I mean, when there's some mass death or some huge sort of public event like that, then there's always an inquiry. I mean, the idea that there shouldn't be one is just...
Well, there's been no coroner's inquest into the death of David Kelly, has there? Extraordinary.
Well, we're jumping on to Kelly there.
No, I'm just saying.
I agree. I mean, you know, but one of the problems with the inquest has been, I think, simply that some of those fundamental questions that anyone that's studied 7/7 seriously, and I can tell you the reason that I was so. I felt so attached to understanding what happened during those London bombings was because I myself worked as a journalist in London during the IRA bombing campaign. I was working on the Stock Exchange bomb, the Baltic Wharf bomb that the IRA were doing, and we were doing our best to make sure there was very balanced reporting of it. As soon as I saw the reporting of the 7/7 London bombings, I was immediately suspicious. There was a lot of the evidence that was coming out, even in the first couple of weeks, which was just contradictory. And there was a complete lack of photographic evidence to put these four guys on the actual trains at the time. And you would have thought that that would be actually elementary, that there's CCTV cameras everywhere.
This is it. And the fact that there was no inquiry, what we had in its place was an official statement by the government, which was basically handed to the press and read out verbatim as fact.
Well, even though it was shown to be wrong, because people proved that they couldn't have caught that train because that train didn't run.
Well,
and then John Reid, who was the Home Secretary at the time, had to go to the House of Commons and say, that train didn't run. Now, that is because people like ourselves were not prepared to take at face value what we were being told. Because of our knowledge of what went on in Ireland and what went on in the past, we're not necessarily prepared to believe what the government tells us, and nor should we be. We should always be critical. But I think we must also keep an open mind folks, because it may be that four misguided guys did set off to do that and did it. I'm not saying otherwise, but I'm not necessarily going to believe what the government says just because the government says it.
The other thing,
we don't trust them at all.
Well, I think that's the problem we have, though, in this country at the moment, that whatever the authority figure are telling us, the government or the Prime Minister or Home Secretary or whoever, we're actually taking it as gospel, and that's the problem, because we're not actually investigating.
Well, that's the problem, isn't it? The documentaries like The Ludicrous Diversion, which anyone who's got access to the internet can go and watch, is a half an hour. It's actually very easy to watch.
Effect.
Has never been shown on British television. And I think that's really a great shame. I think it was shown on Edge TV, one television channel, Sky 200.
Can I just add here, Tony and myself were part of a documentary called the Conspiracy Files 7-7 documentary as a result of our work on
that was on
the
BBC Two.
That was on BBC Two, but Tony has also been on a Press TV documentary about the London bombings, haven't you, Tony?
Yeah, it was really a discussion about some of the conspiracy theories.
Press TV being Iranian TV.
And to be fair, there has been an inquest now, and quite a lot of people associated with it, I'm talking about the survivors and the victims' families, have got some form of satisfaction through that inquest, even though actually it should have been a public inquiry, not an inquest. But an inquest is for a single individual death. A public inquiry is what you're supposed to have when there's multiple deaths. And there has actually been quite a lot of interesting stuff come out through that.
But no CCTV footage from the day.
There are still many survivors who haven't had their questions answered. And they had a press conference just before the beginning of the inquest saying, we're not at all happy with this process. We keep being told by the authorities that we're going to have our questions answered, and then we're told, I'm sorry, actually your questions won't be answered.
A key question, of course, is what did MI5 or MI6 know, and when did they know it? Because we were told in the immediate aftermath of the bombing that these guys were acting on their own, that they were clean skins, that they had no record, and then we find out that in actual fact they claim they've been to a training camp in Pakistan, where this guy who was running it in the US turns out to have been a US agent all along. And Harun Rashid Aswat was named by the Metropolitan Police as the mastermind, had been on the phone to all of the lads the week before, and then of course he was named by John Loftus from the US as a former Attorney General as an MI6 double agent. Can you
just a bit, John Loftus wasn't a former Attorney General, he was a former special investigator for the FBI into into Nazis who'd been living in
America. All right, but I mean, the point I'm making here is that you can have, in Pakistan the same will be true, you have so-called jihadi groups going out doing unspeakable things, but they are themselves being manipulated by people further up the line who are in the state apparatus.
But one day a few months ago saying, Martin, that the 7-7 bombing, the MI5 and MI6 could have actually stopped it if they wanted to, because
it may be that the MI5 and MI6 don't want to stop it, and that's the issue. And that's what people have got to understand.
I mean, the thing is, with that argument, I mean, it's easy to say in hindsight that they could have stopped it. They had a few photographs of the guys. I mean, I'm playing devil's advocate maybe here a little bit. I can see everyone staring at me. Tony, what are you saying here? But it is very easy to look back at an event like that and say, well, hang on a minute, why didn't you guys stop it? The most important thing is that the people that allowed at MI5, that didn't do their job, at the anti-terrorist branch, the Metropolitan Police, that didn't do their job, who allowed 7-7 to happen, are still in their jobs. In fact, they may even have been promoted.
But the thing is, though, Tony, I mean, when we say this kind of thing, oh, he wasn't a nobody, or you know, the other person wasn't a nobody. We heard about 9/11, how the CIA knew a few years back, or in the previous administration, they knew about this was going to happen, and they just stopped it. I mean,
There are two concepts that we can use here. One is called LIHOP and the other MIHOP, which is what we use in the LIHOP is let it happen on purpose. Yeah, so you could have stopped it. The other one is MIHOP, made it happen on purpose. Now, in actual fact, I think both my own personal view is that 9/11 definitely was made it happen on purpose. We've got 1,000 architects and engineers saying the three buildings that collapsed that day couldn't have been brought down in the way that they're suggesting. It's just physically impossible. So, but I suspect that 7-7 is either a let it happen on purpose or possibly a made it happen on purpose. What makes me say made it happen on purpose is the explosives. The IRA experimented with hydrogen peroxide in the 1970s, and they stopped using it a long time ago because it's much too unstable. You either blow yourself up with it or it doesn't work. Mm. And as we saw on July the 23rd, another lot of bombers trying to use hydrogen peroxide, none of their bombs
this
went off.
This is the chapati flour bomb.
Yes. Yeah,
none of them bubbled.
None of them went off. Now we've got a French police officer who came out of Scotland Yard on the day of the attacks and said, "This is all very worrying. It looks as if they were using C4 explosive, which is standard US Army issue explosive." And then that disappeared. And one of the things we did, caller, and for others listening, is that when these events happen, get straight onto your computer and download everything immediately, because most of it will disappear.
Yep.
But once you've done, I mean, the thing that really first struck my attention, because you were out of the country, Tony, and I phoned you back at 33rd and said, "Do you do realise that Benjamin Netanyahu had a warning about the bombs?" Because that came out, that Benjamin Netanyahu was supposed to be at a meeting at Liverpool Street that morning and he didn't turn up. The Jerusalem Post phoned the embassy and said, "What is Bibi all right?" Said, "It's fine, we had a warning."
Yeah, he didn't even leave his hotel.
He didn't even leave his hotel.
Now, first,
how is it that the Prime Minister of Israel, who's visiting London, has a warning?
He wasn't the Prime Minister at the time.
Well,
he
was the Finance Minister. Yeah. How come he has a warning about this bomb attack? And the Conspiracy Files film tried to deal with this, and they just had some guy from the Israeli embassy saying, "Oh, well, we said we had a warning, but it was just a mix-up."
But
that's not really satisfactory as an explanation, is it?
No, absolutely. But shouldn't these people say that they knew about this was going to happen? If the events taken place, and it, I mean, for example, 9/11 took 6,000 lives, the London bombing took, a few lives, 50 odd lives, shouldn't these people then be prosecuted and, you know, be brought to trial?
Well, ultimately, that's what's got to happen, unless we're going to have a civil war.
We are once again close to the break. Just like to say also that any opinions or views reflected by presenters or callers into the studio are, of course, the opinions don't necessarily represent the opinions of Unity FM. Please do call us 0121 772 8892. Call us in live
On 93.5 Unity FM. This is Behind the Headlines, live on the show today. Tony Godley, Martin Thomas, Steve Dolly, myself, Saeed Ahmed, Tariq Ziad, and Humayun. All of us are here live, and you can also join us on 0121 772 8892. Last half hour of the show to go. It's been a fascinating show, actually, for the last 1.5 hour. If you've just joined us, you missed an excellent show today, actually, if I say so myself.
Yeah, please do phone in and tell us we're wrong. Please.
Absolutely. I mean, I disagree with, and we take all opinions. It's just not one-sided.
What's the number again?
0121 772 8892.
Can I just quickly make a little community announcement here as well? Dr. Babuna, MD Brain Surgeon, and Dr. Gundogdu, MD, part of the Harun Yahya team, are in the UK until the 11th of March for the Harun Yahya series. They will be in Manchester at Salford University on the 9th of March from 5 p.m. That's Salford University at John Dalton Building, opposite BBC Building, Oxford Road, Manchester, M15GD. You can telephone, I think that's 0781 4743 808, or 0789 105 3757, or you can email sulfur.onereason@gmail.com, and topics will include evolution, fact or fiction. We're just a fascinating discussion with Martin, Steve and Tony on the evidence surrounding 7/7, or rather the media censorship, and our fellow presenter Humayun just had a little question for Martin and Tony there.
An interesting one.
I just wanted to ask why the mainstream stations and media did not publicise the information that you guys have, and what have they got to gain from it?
Well, I think there are several reasons, and they kind of compound on one another. One of the most important ones is guilt. The mainstream media have basically, over the few weeks after the 7/7 London bombings and maybe the year or whatever since it, took a very strong line. Basically, that these four guys did it. Now, they can say that because they didn't survive. If they had been suspects, if they had survived, these four alleged bombers, then they would have been called exactly what I just called them, alleged bombers. As they didn't survive, what's happened is the mainstream media has bought the whole police line that these guys were the bombers, they were the killers, and they have been talked of as that. In fact, there's Nafees Ahmed, who wrote one of the first and most excellent books on the London bombing.
It is a very good book.
Told me that when he wrote that book in manuscript form, it had actually, it didn't have the bombers written in it anywhere. It said the alleged bombers, all the way through. And his publisher actually told him, sorry, but we're going to take the alleged out. So as you can see, there's a little bit of censorship there.
Well, not just that, Tony, but I mean, there's a whole section of the book which is actually completely censored. And that is actually the part where Nafees Musaddiq, the writer of the book, actually put together the fact that Al-Muhajirun appear to have been, obviously, a tool for MI5 or MI6 that were used to recruit young people to get involved in terrorist activities and to go and carry out something like the attacks that took place on the 7th of July.
Now, is that redacted or blacked out, that part of the book, because it's a threat to national security?
That's
or because it's a threat to the embarrassment, or it's an embarrassment to MI5, I wonder?
It's a well-known fact that jihadi groups in Britain have been working with the intelligence services since the 1980s, since Operation Cyclone, when the MI6 was the lead agency on setting up the jihad in Afghanistan.
Okay, sorry, Martin, we just got a caller. Sorry to interrupt you there. Hello, caller.
Hello, caller.
Assalamu alaikum. Hi, guy. It's me, Gaji.
Hello, Gaji.
Hello, Gaji. What would you like to say today?
Basically, I want to talk about the Libyan revolution.
Yep.
Fire away.
Basically, I want to know whether you think the Western countries actually support the revolution, or whether they're just pretending to support the revolution.
Well, I think it's quite interesting. I mean, we're sitting here in the studio in Birmingham, and knowing what's going on in Libya is very difficult at the moment. I mean, I'm trying to follow it, as I'm sure you are. I don't know if people have seen this, but I've been seeing this week on Press TV, which is Iranian TV, talking about Colonel Gaddafi, the Libyan regime, being given 50,000 mercenaries from Chad by the Israelis. The Israelis are supporting Gaddafi's regime.
I've come across that report.
Yes, and it's originally sourced within the Israeli press. Yeah, Press TV have covered it, and they give the sources in Israel for this. So it looks as if the Israeli regime, which supported Mubarak, if you remember,
yes,
and supported Ben Ali in Tunisia, they would like the status quo in the rest of the Middle East. And they've always found Gaddafi the kind of person they could do business with at the end of the day.
But I find that
they don't want to see change.
I found that a bit weird, Martin, because Gaddafi was one of the most anti-Israeli, pro-Palestinian leaders in the whole of the Middle East and North Africa.
In rhetorical terms, yeah? He talks a lot. But in actual fact, Gaddafi has done is a rather nasty piece of work. He's a gangster. He does business with who pays him. And therefore, he's got a working relationship with the Israelis that goes back a long way. I think it's not clear who the Libyan revolutionaries are. I wish them well. I mean, my instinct is to support them. But I don't know who they are, and I don't know whether they are going to be in the pockets of the West or not. But I think that if you think about the struggle in Libya now, the revolutionaries are trying to persuade sections of the army which are still loyal to Gaddafi to desert. Now, the last thing they need is outsiders coming in and turning it into a kind of Libya versus outside intervention battle. They're trying to get people to change sides, which is why they're so angry about the SAS turning up in the desert and messing up that, you know, it makes it look as if they are being manipulated by outside forces.
Okay, Gaji, did you have any other questions?
Well, actually, I didn't have any other questions, but I just want to respond to that. Basically, the SAS going in at night on a secret mission.
Right.
The British government is saying that they were diplomats and, you know, they were just there to protect the diplomats.
Yes.
Obviously, you guys have talked about their clauses on their false passports and the false currency. You know, these are for multiple countries. They had these.
Well, we never actually mentioned false currency. We mentioned false passports.
Yeah.
And mainly the explosives, I believe.
I mean, do you think that if the Western countries are still supporting Gaddafi, do you think that maybe they were trying to frame the revolutionaries?
Well, it could be that they were going to plant a bomb in Benghazi, for example, and claim that the Gaddafi people had done it. Or it could be that they're going to plant a bomb in Gaddafi territory and claim that the revolutionaries had done it.
Yeah,
I think ultimately they want to control the oil in Libya, whoever wins the civil war. So they're basically probably prepared to either do it. I mean, they were doing a deal with Gaddafi until 2 weeks ago. There's all sorts of pictures of British diplomats and Tony Blair going over. Giving
him
a big hug.
Yes, I've seen that picture, yeah.
I mean, it was also
a hug of death from Tony Blair.
Yes.
It was also alleged, I mean, this weekend, an article on, again, on a news source, Blacklisted News, that the Americans are supplying weapons to the Libyans through means they're using Saudi as the means to supply these weapons.
Yeah, I mean, all of these things are going on. It's speculation at this stage, isn't it?
Plausible.
It's plausible. I mean, that's why I went back through some of the history of the SAS and the things that they've done in the past, so that people can understand that it may be that they're on a sabotage mission. That's what it looks like to me. They don't look as if it's a diplomatic mission at all. That's a cover story. They're on some kind of sabotage mission, but the question is what? And it's only speculation. I think what the Western powers want is they want a stable government in Libya, which is going to sell the oil to them at a price they're happy with. Mm. That's what their ultimate goal is. If that's Gaddafi, that's Gaddafi. If it's not Gaddafi, it's whoever else they can find. But the Israelis, on the other hand, just want to see the status quo.
Well, I mean,
so you saw them, the Israelis backing Mubarak when Obama and Cameron decided to ditch him.
This may be the way that they're running some of these, inverted commas, revolutions, because if you look at the situation in Libya, we've got the British and the US quite clearly being very supportive of the rebels, and yet their allies, the Israelis, being supportive of Gaddafi. So it's like they're playing both sides in all these conflicts, possibly.
Yeah, but don't forget that the Israelis' interests are not necessarily the same as those of the Americans and the British, and that may eventually...
Well, I would have thought, Martin, taking this into a different angle...
Hold that thought for a second. I think we have some more callers. Callers, you're live on air.
Assalamu alaikum.
Walaikum salam.
We've been talking about conspiracy theories and how, like, the government might be involved in, like, 7/7 and 9/11. But one question was, like, why would they be involved? What are the reasons? And, like, a lot of people say, like, stuff like Illuminati and, you know, things like that. The question is, are these things plausible, like Illuminati and, you know, Freemasonism and that?
I think that question would be put to Tony, actually.
A very interesting question.
Well, certainly Freemasonry is plausible. Freemasonry is all over the place. We had hundreds of thousands of Freemasons here in Britain, and Britain is the headquarters of world Freemasonry.
Aren't they just funny chaps that give you little funny handshakes and, you know...
Mm.
Isn't it all just like, you know, just harmless, you know,
and celebrities, old
men and, you know...
Well, quite a lot of people are recruited into Freemasonry. I think, you know, you can look at it... if you want to look at Freemasonry, you can't really ignore the history, because... There was something very positive about Freemasonry historically here in Britain. It were quite strict rules around religion, where people couldn't say things. There was a sort of blasphemy laws and these kinds of things in the past. And Freemasonry represented something quite good, actually, which was a kind of speakeasy where people could get together in private and they could actually speak their mind. And they had a kind of pact with each other, where they would say, well, look, you say, just be honest with us, and we promise we won't dob you into anybody, and it's a private conversation. And you can see why a Masonic lodge with maybe 20 or 30 Freemasons, that is actually gives, it actually is at a positive side, a positive spin on it, and there is freedom of speech in that small group, in a society which is actually quite an intolerant society. But things have moved on since those hundreds of years ago.
Mm.
So you do wonder, what is the relevance of Freemasonry today? The other thing to say is the whole thing is very strictly organised into degrees and levels of Freemasonry. So at your first initiation, you are a first-degree Freemason, another initiation, and you become a second degree, and you work your way up, slowly up through the ladder. And I wouldn't like to say anything about Freemasonry if I hadn't personal contacts who were former Freemasons. And some of those are fairly low-level Freemasons who've gone into it and then decided they didn't like it. But I've also met some people who were very senior Masonic people. I mean, talking about Knights Templar, 30th in the 30th degree, you know, very high level in their system. And they've made it very, very clear to me that this is a system which has its positive sides, because other Freemasons all around the world, if you acknowledge as a Mason with secret signs, secret handshakes and this kind of thing, will help you out. Beyond the call of duty.
Is it true, Tony, all this business about the occult?
But the negative side of it is, he told me himself, at the top, Tony, it's evil. That actually these people are into it for power and nothing else. And even though it's got this kind of nice image with nice imagery, and the Freemasons will try and tell you it's not a religion, it's not a cult, we don't have a temple. If you look into their literature, they talk about their temples in their Masonic halls the whole time. So there's a great deal of hypocrisy. And I think when people get into Freemasonry, thinking this is going to be for privilege and promotion in society, maybe to get a better job, this kind of thing, meet the right people who are going to help your career, they don't realize that actually what they're getting into is actually a religious cult.
But surely, Tony, it's just a bunch of funny old men. They don't have any control over anything.
Well, they do, because there's a lot of people who are in powerful positions in society who are Freemasons. I mean, in the legal profession, judges, police. Imagine a courtroom situation where you've got a Freemason solicitor, a Freemason judge, and a Freemason prosecution barrister, where you've got several people in that courtroom who are all actually personal friends, not just through drinking at the bar or down the courthouse, but they're in a Masonic lodge. My own contacts have shown me very clearly that there is sometimes criminal activity going on in these amongst these Masonic contacts in the lodges. For example, in Dorset, a friend of mine had his Jeep stolen, very expensive Jeep stolen. He found it the next day for sale on the forecourt of a garage. So he went to the police immediately, saying, "Where's my stolen Jeep?" And he found the police were actually really unhelpful. They didn't believe it was his Jeep. They said, "Oh, we think you must have just sold it for cash during the night." And they didn't believe that he even had his Jeep stolen. Well, it turned out later that the garage owner and the policeman who was supposed to be investigating that crime were both in the same Masonic lodge. So there, it does create a possibility. I'm not saying all Freemasons are bad. Of course they're not. But it creates quite a nice possibility for collusion and criminal activity. And I think that's the most worrying thing about Freemasonry today.
Is it all kind of checking upon and like...
Regulation,
just to check any kind of that judges and police officers.
Well, for a long time, actually, Chris Mullin in the last Labour government did try and make registration mandatory for all public servants who were Freemasons, including the police. The police then got that knocked back and said, "Oh, we think this would be bad for police credibility." So they actually stopped the registration of all Freemasons. And I can tell you, having spoken to police off the record in Bristol, I don't know what the situation is like up here, but honest police are really annoyed about the infiltration of the police services, the higher levels of the police service, by Freemasons. Mm. And they see it as a real serious problem. In fact, when I asked the sector inspector in the city centre in Bristol, who's an inspector himself, if he was a Freemason, and this is the best thing, is just ask people directly to them, "Are you a Freemason?" He actually swore at me. And he said, "No." And I won't use the swear word. But he said, and this was in a public meeting, actually. And he said, "And none of my lads are." And you could tell from the tone of his voice that he realised it was actually a serious problem in the police.
One person
force.
Who talks about Freemasonry and the infiltration of Freemasonry into police, government, etc., is a man called Brian Gerrish. And he actually cites a particular think tank or organisation, doesn't he, Tony, which he feels is a kind of a Freemasonic front and has actually been responsible for major political leaders of recent times as well.
Well, I don't know whether Common Purpose, which is this charity you're is actually anything to do with the Freemasons, although it does seem very secretive. Certainly, we tried to ask them some questions about the way that they conduct their business. Basically, what they are is they're kind of tapping people like Steve here, or maybe not Steve, I don't know, on the shoulder to say, "You are going to be the leaders of tomorrow." And they take you on these special, quite expensive training courses where they teach you to be a leader. The only trouble is, a lot of the people that they're tapping are actually quite weak people, people who actually aren't very knowledgeable and are easy to manipulate. So then, once you've done one of their courses, which involves you talking quite a lot about some of your very personal stories that in your childhood, your past, and this kind of thing, so actually they've got quite a lot of information about you. I find that a bit creepy. Mm-hmm. I don't want to talk to any stranger that I don't trust and I don't know about my personal life. And that is really one of the reasons why Common Purpose is very, I think, a suspect organisation, because it seems to me that they're trying to pick out people to make them be the leaders and stop potential leaders like Steve here, you know, get in the way of people like him, who is actually a great thinker and a mover and shaker in society. So I don't know about the Masonic connection, but, you know, I certainly think that Common Purpose is an organisation people should be wary of and educate themselves on. You'll find that Common Purpose have got their own website with their own information, and all the people who are critical have got their own website too, so you'll find very different points of view on the internet.
Can I just chip in
here? I was going to ask you, Martin, actually, for your input here, actually.
Yeah, I think people are mistaking it. If they think that the people who carried out 9/11, in my view, was definitely an inside job.
Yes.
7/7, I've got an open mind about, but I'm very suspicious. 9/11, definitely. 10 years later, we've got the 10th anniversary coming up this September. There's a very interesting website called Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth with Architects and Engineers on it, but there's also Military Officers for 9/11 Truth. Look that one up. It's got
there's also Pilots for
9/11 Pilots for 9/11 Truth, indeed. Yeah, yes. I think it's growing all the time. This movement is building and growing. Robert Falk, who's the UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights on Palestine, he's come out and said it was an inside job. We've got Alan Hart, who's been on this programme the other week.
An American judge side, I believe, as well.
Yeah, it's... The point about this is, the people who did it didn't do it because they are part of a secret evil cult. Mm. They may be, but they did it because they are greedy, selfish people. That's why they did it. They don't have to be part of a satanic cult to be greedy and selfish.
But Marty,
it's natural. It's always been the way. Hitler was not a Freemason, Mussolini was not a Freemason, Julius Caesar was not a Freemason, Napoleon. It's the same kind of people doing this, and it's part of human nature, sadly.
Like Romain asked earlier, what do they stand to gain from it all then?
Well, a lot of money. We know for a fact that, for example, you think about the put options on 9/11, where people took bets that certain airline shares would go down.
Really?
Yes. And they made a lot of money on it. But that money didn't lead back to a cave in Afghanistan. It led back to a guy called Buzzy Krongard, who was then working for Deutsche Bank, who used to be executive director of the CIA. Now, there's also evidence that masses of fraudulent transactions went through the computers in the World Trade Center in the minutes before the attack.
People were actually hedging on September 11th.
Yes, yes, yeah. And that was one of the things that came out after the week after.
I heard one of those rumours.
Yes, but you know why you never heard anything more about that?
No.
Because it didn't lead back to Osama bin Laden.
You know what? It was the wrong story. And this is, I'm afraid, something I used to hear in the newsroom quite a bit in London was... That's the wrong story, Tony.
Well, there was an investigation in the US into this, and it was a ridiculous conclusion. They said, well, there were some people who'd taken these bets and hedged against this who must have had foreknowledge, but because these people have got no links with Al-Qaeda, that can't be it. And it's like, well, hang on a minute. You presume that Al-Qaeda did it, and therefore they should have links with Al-Qaeda. But in actual fact, no, they've got links with the US security establishment. But of course, we can't, you know, this is how the thing has been finessed. And ultimately, underlying all of this, we were talking about the bankers earlier paying themselves their bonuses on the back of fraudulent contracts and long-standing fraudulent behaviour. We've got a criminal elite. A criminal elite in the US, a criminal elite in Britain, a criminal elite in countries like Pakistan, who thieve everything that's not nailed down. Mm-hmm. This is just normal. Throughout most of human history, this has been normal. We've only had a little bit of democracy for a very short amount of time. Most of the time, the people running the show are the nastiest people in the society. That's why they're in charge.
Well, Martin, when you talk about frauds, that's actually humane.
I was going to say, you know, the people who want to speak out about the conspiracy theories about 9/11 and 7/7, I think they might be in fear of being unpatriotic, you know?
Well, I personally, I'm very patriotic, and if somebody is blowing up our London Underground and they're inside our own security structure, I want those people dealt with.
Mm-hmm.
That's the bottom line. And I think also, the arguments we're making here are not arguments against the rule of law. We want to see a rule of law. Isn't that right? Surely that's the way.
Yes.
We want whoever carried out these evil acts to be caught, and we don't want the innocent people to be blamed. We want the guilty to be caught and punished, no matter how mighty they be. And if it does lead back to people like Blair and Bush, I think Blair and Bush are fairly low down the food chain, frankly. It's people behind them that we've got to think about. Mm. I mean, I could start naming names, but we might get libel suits or whatever.
Martin, this culture of impunity, which is what you're talking about here, can only take place when you have a judicial system which is flawed, which is where people know that if they do commit a criminal act and that certain people know about it, that actually the prosecution against them will not be pursued, and then even if it does get pursued, they will get off. There's got to be an understanding that people are going to be able to get away with this stuff, otherwise it wouldn't happen.
Well, I mean, if you look back to the war in Ireland over the last 30 years, one of the underlying things driving that was the belief, on the Republican side in particular, that they could not get justice. that their people would not get a fair trial, and that the stuff that the other side did, like all of the murders discussed in this book, The Nemesis File by Paul Bruce, as I mentioned earlier, nobody's ever been prosecuted for any of those murders, and nor will they ever be. And of course, at a certain point, young people particularly say, well, if that's the case, and you've killed my brother, well, I'm going to go out and kill some of your people. And that's how terrorism starts and grows.
Now,
and that's why you have to have a rule of law which is fair to everybody, and that means the new police service in Northern Ireland has been agreed by both communities now, and both communities are supporting it. And we need to have a similar attitude here. We're not here to, I want to see a rule of law. I want to see the police do their job, which is arrest the really guilty parties.
Now, no, that's actually the case right now over in Egypt, because
yes,
we might
probably
remember, on New Year's Day, there was a devastating bomb explosion at the Coptic Christian Church in Cairo. Was it in Alexandria? Then what happened was, we had a kind of a revolution. And one of the things that happened during that revolution was the two policemen who planted that bomb...
They weren't policemen, they were secret police
secret
agents.
Police, all right. Working for a secret squad for the Interior Ministry of 22 secret police, went to the British Embassy, where Martin takes up the story.
Yeah, they went to the British Embassy and said, we planted that bomb. And but in actual fact, what happens, there were three of them, and the one guy who drove the car bomb in, they blew the car bomb up with him in it, yeah? And then the other two escaped, and then they came to a meeting with Al Arabi, who is now on trial for corruption, because he called them in for a debrief on what had happened. And then he immediately arrested them and said, ha-ha, we've got the bombers. And, of course, the bombers were themselves... one was from Jundullah, which is an extremist jihadi group in Egypt. Another one was from another group. So these were ostensibly jihadis, but it turns out that they were working for the Interior Ministry.
We're a couple of minutes away from the break now. Well, not the break, but actually the final thing of
the show.
So perhaps we just get a few last thoughts from everybody, just we round things up.
I'd just like to say about that last story, I think actually this is where the hope lies. What's happened in Egypt is there is a recognition that the government was so deeply into corruption that it was time to actually have a revolution, get rid of them, and start prosecuting people who are in some key positions. And I guess we're going to be seeing this happening in other parts of the world too. And the lovely thing about what happened in Alexandria is that we saw Muslims praying with Christians together to protect each other, so that nobody could say that this was the Muslims attacking the Christians, because they were all intermingled, and that, so that then the dirty tricks of the Interior Ministry were absolutely thwarted by people just literally praying together.
Steve, a quick last thought?
Just a thought about prosecuting those people at the top. I mean, the world's upside down. You know, if you lie, if you're a president and you lie about a sexual affair, you get impeached. But if you lie in order to lead us into an illegal war, you get away with it.
Fantastic, isn't it?
Martin, if you...
I think I'd just like to say what great pleasure it's been to be here in person tonight. We've come down deliberately for that reason. I think that revolutions are catching. If we can get some revolutions going in the Middle East, as we seem to be doing, then perhaps that will all lead back to our own bad guys, and we'll get the lot of them.
Do you reckon we could have a revolution here, Martin?
Well, I think it's already happening, though, in Madison, Wisconsin, in the United States. Yeah. We're seeing some amazing things happening
The economy here is going to melt down, and when that happens, people are going to wake up.
We'd like to thank Tony and Martin for coming all the way from Bristol today, from Bristol City, Bristol Community FM did it again. Catch them every Friday, 5 till 7, on www.bcfm.org.uk. Thanks very much to Steve Jolly and to everybody who contributed to today's show. We'll be back next week, 8 till 10 p.m., and we're here every Tuesday at the same time.
Thanks very much for having us, guys. Thank you.
And it's been a pleasure. You guys have been coming down here. Today's been fantastic. And you can listen to this show again on Mixcloud, or you can go to radioforall.net. Until next week, then, if you've got little ones, give them a hug, give them a kiss. Tell them you love them. Good evening. I'll take care.